The Books That Made Me.
My guest today is the award-winning writer China Mieville. He's part of a cluster of science fiction authors loosely defined as the New Weird. His second novel, Perdido Street Station, won the prestigious Arthur C. Clarke Award, but it also gained him a reputation beyond fantasy circles, which has grown with each successive novel. So far, there have been 8 of them. He has a busy life outside writing as well, teaching creative writing at Warwick and standing as a parliamentary candidate for the Socialist Alliance in 2001. China, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Apart from the fact that my whole family are fans of your novels, I thought you'd be a great person to interview for The Books That Made Me, because your novels reference other books so explicitly. You've said that you hope to write one in each genre, from classic American Western, as in The Iron Council, to Sequest, as in The Scar, to detective noir, as in The City and the City. So you're somebody who reads other people's work quite avidly as well as writing your own.
I think probably most writers do, but I suppose it might partly be a generational thing that I grew up with sampling technology, as, you know, all the music we were hearing was kind of cobbled together from these samples of other work. And I think that kind of very, very respectful but rather piratical filching and sticking together is something that's quite important. So for me and a lot of other writers, so I certainly try and sort of put a lot of kind of references and nods, and sometimes teasing, sometimes respectful. But yeah, I like that sort of texture.
So now let's go to your first choice of book.
The first book I've chosen is The Tale of Mr. Jeremy Fisher by Beatrix Potter. Michael Moorcock wrote an essay in which he said that he had never enjoyed reading Winnie the Pooh, The Wind in the Willows, or any other tale of talking vermin, which kind of really sort of puts the kibosh on animal stories. But I've always insisted on an opt-out clause, an exception clause for Beatrix Potter, because there's something, I think, very unsentimental. They're very strange books, I think, and they're not sort of twee and cuddly at all, despite, I think, they're sometimes having that image. And this particular one was always my favourite, primarily for one page, which is page 40, which is where Jeremy Fisher is sitting on a lily pad, and unbeknownst to him, a trout is swimming up underneath him and is about to bite his to grab him by his leg, and he can't see it, and we the reader can. And I have very, very vivid memories of getting closer and closer to that page and getting more and more frightened and being really scared to turn the page, but also being completely compelled to turn the page. And I think, you know, that whole kind of vein of love for and fascination with and fear of the kind of underwater monster, for me, is probably ground zero for that, is page 40 of The Tale of Mr. Jeremy Fisher. I think it's a truly amazing piece of work.
You've got a pile of books in front of you. Let's hear a little bit from each one of them as you go along, and let's start with Jeremy Fisher.
Okay. And while Mr. Jeremy sat disconsolately on the edge of his boat, sucking his sore fingers and peering down into the water, a much worse thing happened. A really frightful thing it would have been if Mr. Jeremy had not been wearing a Macintosh.
Did you find that you actually had to hide the book? I actually had a copy of A Little Grey Rabbit book, which I ripped the back off because I was so terrified when I realised what the story was that was contained in it.
No, I think because I always have I'm kind of attracted to my own fears. I think a lot of people who like horror and like sort of scary stories, that there's a sort of simultaneous attraction repulsion. And so I was genuinely really scared. And I remember literally holding the edge of the page and like half turning it and kind of steeling myself. But I also very much wanted to turn that page. That was the point of the book for me. So although I was frightened, it would have been sacrilegious to tear it out or to hide it, because that was the whole point of it. I kept coming back to it.
So now let's go to your second book.
Well, this is another illustrated book, but this is all illustrations. This is Une Semaine de Bonté by Max Ernst, a surrealist novel in collage where he's taken lots and lots of images from things like Victorian etchings and a lot of catalogues, black and white catalogues from the late 19th century and early 20th century. And he's with extraordinary patience and skill kind of cut them up and pasted them together so that it tells a story in this wordless, very strange, very opaque way. The way he puts them together, you really can't, in many cases, see the join at all, so that you have this tale of like the sea and dragons and lions, and there's a whole section with birds where the what appears to be the protagonist keeps going from scene to scene with his head become a bird's head. And I always liked black and white art, crosshatched illustrations. And when I first kind of came across Max Ernst's work as a sort of young teenager, it was really a bomb going off in my head. And I love the fact that this does tell a story and that you can trace a narrative through it, but that, of course, it's always a very sort of ambiguous narrative, and yet somehow it still manages to be kind of exciting and strange. So in some ways it's a comic strip, in some ways it's a whodunit, although I kind of think of it more as a whodunwhat, really. So it's a very powerful work for me.
It doesn't have any words in it at all.
There are a few words, but the vast majority of it are these extraordinary images.
So now, you say you discovered this as a teenager. That's a very extraordinary book to discover. How did you do so? You were in Norfolk. Where did you discover a book like this? It's by a French surrealist painter.
Well, I mean, I grew up in London. I was born in Norwich, but I grew up in London, I would love to claim some kind of tremendously recherché radical chic, but I don't think I can, really. I think probably quite a lot of slightly nerdy, enthusiastic, you know, sort of fantastic influenced geeky kids find the surrealists quite early, and you know I used to go to the Tate a lot. This is Tate Britain, as is now, you know, and I remember, you know, being in my sort of mid-teens and going to exhibitions, and one of the first exhibitions that I went to that had a huge impact on me was this enormous Ernst exhibition, and, you know, these enormous decalcomania paintings he does, where he smears paint with glass, and all these things. And then in one room there were these collages put together, and they were, you know, selling copies of the book. You can buy it reasonably cheap. It's nice reproductions. So it was just a nice piece of kind of parallel evolution. I think it sort of slotted very nicely into a Max Ernst shaped hole in my head.
Well, there are no words as such in this, so give us a flavour of it. Well,
this is the introduction to the second book, Monday, The Element Water. Example, water. What do you see? Water. What colour is this water? The colour of water.
So at that stage, were you going to be a writer, or were you also toying the idea of being an artist?
I don't remember what I wanted to do at that stage. I mean, I was drawing a lot, and I still do, but I think I was beginning to lean more into writing. But for me, art is very, very important as part of the writing. I draw a lot of the things that I write about, and I do a lot of sketches, and my children's book is illustrated by me and stuff like that. So I would like to do more of the art sort of professionally, but it's always felt like, when people ask about your influences, for me, a lot of the influences are visual artists, comic strip artists, and people like the classic surrealists and Paul Klee and people like that. So although I probably always gravitated more towards the words as a writer, at an influential level, the art was a really big thing to me.
Very good. So now let's move on to your choice number three.
This is a book called Mind Blast by Dambudza Marachera, who was a Zimbabwean writer who died quite a long time ago now, who is an absolutely extraordinary writer. And I'm probably, if I had to say my favourite of his books, it would probably be a book called Black Sunlight. But Mind Blast is the one that feels most kind of definitional to me, because it was the first one I read. Also because it's more or less impossible to get in Britain. It was only printed in a very cheap Zimbabwean paperback edition. And I found it completely at random when I was out there many years ago. And so and had no idea what I was reading. And I bought it because it has a guy being interrogated by a giant cat on the cover. So I bought it essentially because it looked as close as I could find to sort of Zimbabwean science fiction, which is definitely an influence, but it's not what it is. It's a collection of poetry, of drama. He was a playwright, of kind of fictionalized reminiscences, these extraordinary kind of anguished, angry essays about the kind of post-colonial condition of being a Zimbabwean during and after the Chimurenga, the freedom struggle. And for a long time, I had a tin ear for poetry. I've been kind of getting back into it recently, but I found it very difficult to read poetry. But he was always an exception. There's something so sort of unbearably powerful and poignant about his writing. And it's very flawed. I mean, he's virtually solipsistic at times. You know, he's very interested in himself. It has a lot of the worst excesses of beat writing. He was very influenced by the beat. So there's a lot of sort of essentially kind of masturbatory fantasies and all that sort of thing. But nonetheless, essentially you're dealing with a kind of a punk poet, Zimbabwean writer, who feels completely sui generis. There's one point later on in Mind Blast where he describes, with what may be a certain amount of kind of romanticization, but nonetheless, he describes his own process of education as being one of crawling around on the rubbish heaps where the discards from the white parts of town were, and finding like these ruined, mouldering paperback novels, Victorian atlases, encyclopedias, and sort of scobbing together this incredibly erudite. He's fantastically erudite, referencing, you know, Anglo-Saxon Kenning through to kind of pulp fiction, through to sort of philosophy, but sort of coagulated together in this kind of rage and a town dump. I always sort of think of him as a kind of gutter modernist.
Can you give us a sense of what sort of writing this is?
I was mesmerised by books at a very early age. I obtained my first one, Arthur Mee's Children's Encyclopedia, at the local rubbish dump where the garbage from the white side of town was dumped every day except Sundays. You never knew what you'd find in that rubbish dump. Broken toys, half-eaten sandwiches, comics, magazines, books. One brilliant blue morning I found what I thought was a rather large doll, but on touching it discovered was a baby, dead, rotting.
Goodness.
He's just like nothing I've ever read, and I find him incredibly moving, warts and all. And I think it's a real sort of travesty that this particular book is not available in Britain. So this is part of my ongoing campaign to...
So you're still campaigning to bring him to public notice?
Well, I mean, there is a creeping increase in notice at the moment. There's been a couple of conferences and whatnot. But, I mean, I think, you know, we could do with some sort of definitive collected editions of his work. He has a couple of lost novels. There's novels for which we have the reader's reports, but we don't have the novels, which may or may not be somewhere in the Heinemann archives somewhere. You know, it's incredibly frustrating. So he's a truly extraordinary writer.
So if anyone has access to the Heinemann archives, please contact us immediately.
Right. I'm looking for A Bowl for Shadows and The Black Heretic. These, I think, are the lost novels.
The lost novels. So what were you doing in Zimbabwe?
I was 17 and 18. I mean, you know, like... I was one of the year off kids. You know, you go and you do your gap year and you're teaching. I spent some time in Egypt and some time in Zimbabwe, and it just had a very, very sort of big impact in terms of primarily, I mean, the overriding sort of legacy for me of Zimbabwe is Marachara. He's something that's just stuck with me for two decades now. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's going anywhere.
So now let's move to your choice number four.
This is Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. This actually was part of the same year. I read it when I was in Egypt, and it was partly I was working in a big industrial city called Mansoura, which had very few English speaking. There were no like English speaking libraries or anything like that. So we had that classic sort of thing of the kind of shamefully monoglot expat who you're kind of frantically scrabbling around reading anything you can get your hands on and reading a lot of books that you would never normally read, which is actually a really great thing to happen. And you know, frankly, I was a teenager. I wasn't interested in Victorian novels. I wasn't interested in kind of romantic novels. I was like, well, I'm gonna have to read Jane Eyre now. It's the only thing left in the cupboard, you know. And it completely blew my mind. And again, it's a book that I sort of tend to reread every year. I think, you know, the world is structured around divisions and of binary divisions. And I think that one of the key binary divisions in the world is whether you're a Jane Eyre person or a Wuthering Heights person, you know. And no disrespect to Wuthering Heights, which is a cracking book, but Jane Eyre completely poons it, in my opinion. The sort of constant sense of kind of sort of something trembling to come out, that this kind of barely, bare control, just control, this kind of sort of rage and emotion and sort of passion. It's an incredibly passionate book, an incredibly angry book. And I think it's also a book that suffers a lot from misremembering. I mean, you know, I often have arguments with people where they'll say, you know, it's really sort of romantic and like sort of sentimental at the end and, you know, and the last line is Reader, I Married Him. And the last line is not Reader, I Married Him. That's the first line of the last chapter. And the last line is about a completely other character. It's about a religious visionary who asked to marry her out of this kind of strange, freaky, sort of intense longing to experience the numinous. It's a very, very strange moment. And so the whole kind of seemingly kind of stabilized sort of happy familial ending, which was never that stable and never that happy anyway, is completely thrown by this kind of outbreak of kind of viral ecstasy at the end of the book. So it's a book that has, as I say, a kind of battened down, barely controlled passion and tension in it that I think is absolutely extraordinary.
So what is it that makes you a Jane Eyre reader rather than a Wuthering Heights reader?
Well, I think it's something to do with tension. Wuthering Heights, it's pretty clear what's going on. And I feel like the thing for me with Jane Eyre is the disparity between the prose. This, you know, like I feel like I'm watching this woman speak and she looks quite buttoned up, and I can just see her trembling. And I can see her trembling with this thing going on under the surface, and it never quite breaks out. But you know it's there.
Is this a reflection of you, or do you think there's a separation between you and your reading?
I don't know. I think I'm probably singularly badly placed to judge. I truly don't know. I don't feel like a particularly tense person. I feel about a lot of the things I love that there's almost like a kind of black box at the core that I can't open, that I don't know. And I can explain, and I can explain down to a certain point, and then there's a kind of nugget in the centre that I can't crack open. Ever since I was very, very young, my fascinations and the things I've loved have remained absolutely unchanging. I'm very faithful to my obsessions. Ever since I was about two, I've loved, you know, monsters, octopuses, spaceships, and
frogs.
Frogs, yes, but more the fish underneath, really. And tension, and that sense of sort of tension. I think the reason I like horror is because of this sense of increasing tension. Whether that, you know, speaks to my kind of incipient psychopathy or, you know, rage or something, I honestly don't know. I think you'd have to ask my friends when I wasn't here.
It's interesting that you mention this thing about tension, and because I've always noticed in your novels it's almost like there's a surface tension that holds worlds apart from each other. Say there's always a meniscus in your books.
I like meniscuses. What is the plural of meniscus?
Maybe it's menisci, but menisci. I don't think there aren't plurals.
Meniscusim. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I like that sense, and that sense of kind of breach, and that sense of you know, something breaking and trying to be held down. I mean, Jane Eyre is full of these. There's a scene in Jane Eyre which, when I read it, I mean, I remember getting these absolute goosebumps up and down my body, which is where she goes into a baker's and she's starving to death. And she asks for a bun, but she doesn't have any money, so she offers her gloves in exchange for the bun. And it's written in this controlled, cold prose, this woman who is going to die of starvation, and the woman behind the counter won't give her a bun for a pair of gloves. And it's like, you know, you talk about sort of Lovecraft as a horror writer. I mean, that's horror right there. That's one of the most extraordinary scenes, you know. Whereas, you know, with Wuthering Heights, it's all shrieking on the moors and you know, whatnot. And, you know, knock yourselves out. But I'd rather Jane Eyre any day.
So let's hear it for the glove.
I found the shop again and I went in. And though others were there besides the woman, I ventured the request. Would she give me a roll for this handkerchief? She looked at me with evident suspicion. Nay, she never sold stuff in that way. Almost desperate, I asked for half a cake. She again refused. How could she tell where I'd got the handkerchief, she said. Would she take my gloves? No. What could she do with them? Reader, it is not pleasant to dwell on these details.
Gosh, that is very creepy. Now to your fifth choice.
I mean, when I was trying to pick the books that that made me, I think is the formulation that you used, on one level, you know, in some ways, loads and loads of them, the majority of them probably should have been nonfiction, because, you know, nonfiction's had a huge impact on me, but particularly politically, reading left theory, socialist theory, over the years. But they're not the books that feel like they kind of sit in my heart. And so actually, this is the only book of nonfiction that I've chosen. And when I was looking for one to almost kind of represent that tradition of reading, I've chosen The General Theory of Law and Marxism by Evgeny Pashukhanis, a Russian legal theorist from the 1920s. It's a very dry-sounding book, and you know, if you're not sort of interested in jurisprudence, then, you know, people may be sort of wondering why, you know, what's so great about it. I mean, it was very important for me because it was one of those books that was like a light going off in my head that this loads and loads of phenomena that I had not even known I wasn't able to understand and explain. I suddenly realized that I was suddenly able to explain and that they had needed explaining. So it's a book that kind of gets me back to absolute first principles. I love its kind of unremitting radicalism, and I love the way it is plugged into a kind of totalizing theory. I've always been very attracted to kind of theories that explain the world, the totality.
Will you give us an example of the writing style?
The concepts of crime and punishment are necessary determinants of the legal form from which people will be able to liberate themselves only after the legal superstructure itself has begun to wither away. And when we begin to overcome and do without these concepts in reality rather than in declarations, that will be the surest sign that the narrow horizon of bourgeois law is finally opening up before us.
So this is a 1920s Russian.
Yeah, yes.
How did you discover him and when?
Because being interested in socialist theory, you follow trains of reading and you start with various classics and then you follow your own sort of fascinations and so on. And this book was one of the books that just totally changed the way I looked at a whole set of social phenomena.
And this was when you were in your 20s? Or?
Yeah, my early 20s, I think, I read it. But I think it's an absolutely beautiful and very sort of elegant, critical way of thinking about this social phenomenon that is not often sort of questioned. And I get quite frustrated with a lot of the, for example, a lot of the debates around the Iraq War. A lot of people with whom, you know, I have a huge amount in common, and I don't mean to sort of, you know, I feel very sort of respectful and close to politically, but they'll sort of say, well, you know, the war was illegal. And I'll say, well, even if that were straightforwardly true, so what? There are plenty of things that are illegal that I would support, and there are plenty of, you know, law-abiding actions that I think were horrendous. You know, I mean, justice and law is not the same thing. And if there's one takeaway from this book, I think, it's the notion that justice and law are not coterminous. And that's a huge insight. It's very simple, but it made an enormous, enormous impact on me.
So now to your sixth choice.
I really wanted to pick a short story collection, an anthology, because they're very, very important in the kind of the world of weird fiction and fantastic fiction that I kind of grew up particularly loving and particularly around. A few years ago, there was I can't remember if it was the Writers Guild, the Society of Authors perhaps started a campaign called Save Our Short Story. There's notion that you know the English short story was disappearing, and those of us who'd been sort of trudging in the genre minds, we're like, you know, doesn't need saving, dude. It's doing fine, thanks very much. You know, it's always been a very important part of our sort of literary tradition, and so I really wanted to kind of reflect on one of those, and I have this huge, you know, numbers and numbers of shelves of these anthologies that I grew up in, and I was having a really difficult time picking one. So this is one that in a way stands as a kind of front end for a whole set, and it's called Creepy Creatures, and it's edited by Barbara Eyerson, and it's putatively for younger readers, the late 70s, early 80s. I know nothing about Barbara Eyerson except that she's a very good... Actually, I have several of her anthologies and stuff. And one of the reasons that I chose this particular one is because she had not just very good taste, but really quite odd taste. So this is a book that's, you know, was sold to us as sort of 10-year-olds and 11-year-olds and so on. And it contains, you know, for example, The Quest for Blank Claveringi by Patricia Highsmith, which is a really strange, very odd, dark comedy about a professor who goes to research and ultimately, spoilers, is eaten by giant snails. And a very, very unrepresentative Highsmith, but, you know, for me, an extraordinary part of my youth. I was never able to look at snails again the same way. It includes the story It by Theodore Sturgeon, which is an absolutely amazing and terribly frightening piece of work. I love the fact that she doesn't hold back. It's about a creature that sort of self-constitutes out of muck and mud. And it's very, very macabre and beautifully written. Sturgeon's an absolutely fantastic writer who has none of that kind of, none of the things that are so often parodied about pulp writers. But I think for me, of all the aspects of the fantastic that I loved, the one that was the most powerful for me was the monsters. And so for a book of nine monster stories, very strange monster stories, very odd choices that I am not sure would be the first choices of monster stories for sort of 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds now. unconstrained by senses of genre, you know, with the Highsmith and so on, unconstrained by literary style, and unconstrained, frankly, by being bloody terrifying.
Read a bit from one of the stories.
Well, this is from It by Theodore Sturgeon. Black and liquidescent it lay in the blackness, not alive, not understanding death, believing itself dead. Things that were alive saw and moved about. Things that were not alive could do neither. It rested its muddy gaze on the line of trees at the crest of the rise, and deep within it thoughts trickled wetly. It lay huddled, dividing its newfound facts, dissecting them as it had dissected live things when there was light, comparing, concluding, pigeonholing.
Very good. So now you read this first when you were 10 or 11, but you still read it now you're an adult. I'm very interested in this idea of play in your work and imaginary worlds and things that actually one would think one might leave behind with one's childhood, but you've taken them forward.
Well, it's interesting you put it that way, because if you write in science fiction or fantasy, you often get asked, how did you get into it? And my answer is always, well, how did you get out of it? Because, you know, if you ask a class of 8-year-olds, you know, they all love stories about this stuff. But then you ask them 8 years later, and a lot of them have stopped and have gone into other things. But I think that those of us that tend to love this stuff simply don't grow out of it. But I think that sense of kind of fidelity to that sense of kind of love of the strange that we had when we were very young is exactly what gets carried over. So I can still read these stories. I mean, for example, It, the story I mentioned, the Theodore Sturgeon story. I mean, I read that story not infrequently, and I know that I've been riffing off it for years. A short story of mine called Familiar is basically a homage to that. That awe, that delight in the strange, I think, is what basically distinguishes those of us that like this sort of thing from those of us who don't like this sort of thing. And I've always liked this sort of thing.
Finally, before I let you go, your luxury reading accompaniment, is it a sort of dragon-shaped bedstead or something?
Are you parodying me? No. Well, I'm very tempted these days to say an iPad, which I'm terribly excited about. But all honesty, it would be something as simple as a bookstand. You know, you can buy these bookstands that look like fold-up deck chairs and things like that. I really don't like those, but years ago, like over a decade ago, I bought this very, very simple book stand that basically looks like a kind of folded-up coat hanger, and it just swivels out. And it's really, really simple design, no bells, no whistles. But if you're someone who likes making notes when you read, if you're someone who likes doodling while you read, if you're someone who likes, eating when you read, I think book stands are absolutely fantastic. So this is I have great loyalty to this particular book stand.
And you read at the table then?
I do. Is that really vulgar?
It's interesting. No, I could never imagine reading at a table.
I do read at the table. And the book stand allows you to eat, you know, big slices of pizza instead of little ones while reading the book and stuff. So yeah, no, I grew up reading at table.
China Mieville, thank you very much for coming in and talking about the books that made you.
Thank you for having me.